Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my great guest co-host today for a recurring show, Dr. Amir Barzin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back today. And Amir, on our show today, we're actually going to be talking with Rudolf Tanzi, director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at the Massachusetts General Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease, about the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's research. One of the foremost Alzheimer's research scholars in the world. Really excited to have him on the show today.
Very excited. Can't wait for that conversation.
You know, we also have some interesting research that matters today. We're going to be talking about innovative research that was done to try to reduce football injuries, about ways of educating patients to participate in research, about electronic cigarettes, and even we got a special guest today, Dr. Cynthia Bulick, to talk about some of her research on bowling. Let's dive right in and talk about our very first research that matters, about helmetless tackling drills. What's that about?
Yeah, so it's a great time to talk about the going on debate about national concussions and head-related injuries, especially as it pertains to youth. So what happened at the University of New Hampshire is that they performed a study talking about helmetless tackling drills. They had some students participate in just non-contact related drills. The other groups participated in helmetless contact drills, which meant that they either didn't wear a helmet and then they tackled either a dummy and or their teammates at about 50 to 75% of the speed.
And they basically found at the end of the season that those who did the helmetless tackling compared to those who actually didn't do any contact during that session had fewer head-related injuries during the regular season, indicating that perhaps these people who have been participating in this helmetless tackling maybe tackled safer during the season. Is that what you're thinking?
That's exactly what they were going at. The trainers and the coaches thought that participating in these drills helped people refine their tackling skills and use the proper form for tackling, thus might be limiting the injuries that they may sustain throughout a season.
Yeah, I'd want to see this replicated in some more research, because I think this would imply a different way of training a lot of kids from junior league up till middle school, high school, even college.
It would be fascinating to see more of it done.
Talking about more research, this next research that matters in the Journal of Clinical Oncology was about how to enroll more people with cancer into clinical trials. And what did they find? What was the outcome?
So what we were looking at here in this study was whether or not patients had the appropriate level of knowledge in whether or not to enroll in clinical trials. Currently, about 5% of patients enroll in clinical trials. And that's important because clinical trials, especially in the setting of cancer, is how we come up with new treatments to help people who are suffering from cancer.
And basically, in this research, they gave an educational program, a tailored video, so it may be addressed whether they're concerned about taking a placebo, maybe about the quality of life, the quantity of life. And those that looked at this tailored program, 21%, four times more increase in those who enrolled in clinical research. I think this is the wave of the future. We really do need to create better models rather than just thinking that people can read something on their own.
Yeah, I think that this is showing that we have different ways to bring the information to all of our patients. And the better that we can do that, the more educated our patients will be, the better decisions they can make.
Last research that matters was on e-cigarettes and vapor extract and deciding whether or not that extract could actually be causing cancer.
Yeah, this is very fascinating. For a long time now, we've been looking at e-cigarettes and how many people are using them as a way to kick the habit of smoking conventional cigarettes. But we, as a medical community, are still torn on the absolute benefits and harms of using them.
Yeah, and we do worry that these are not FDA, Food and Drug Administration, regulated. They haven't been proven safe. And in the GIST journal, Oral Oncology, they basically found that the vapor from two popular brands of e-cigarettes in the treatment of human cells in dishes compared to those that were not treated with this vapor extract, the vapor extract actually was cancer promoting. So lots of questions about the research, but it does, again, this is a voice of caution. We need to probably see what the Food and Drug Administration does. Hopefully it'll happen soon.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting about this was the fact that the vapors didn't even have any nicotine in it. It was just the use of the vapor itself.
Wow. Now, as a special part of today's Research That Matters, we'd like to welcome back to our show Dr. Cynthia Bulick, director of the UNC Center for Excellence for Eating Disorders and a former great guest on our show to talk about research she and her colleagues at UNC and Duke have done on the relationship between eating disorders and bullying. Welcome, Dr. Bulick. Thanks for being with us again today.
Thanks for having me back.
Dr. Bulick, your recent study in the International Journal of Eating Disorders covered the relationship between eating disorders and bullying. Could you please describe a little bit for our listeners what you found during your research?
Sure. I think one of the things that's really unique about this study is that we didn't just look at people who were victims of bullying, but we also looked at two other groups. We looked at people who were what we called bully victims. So they were people who were victims of bullying, but also bullied themselves. And then the third group was we actually looked at people who bullied other children. And what we wanted to see was the extent to which or whether bullying was associated with eating disorder symptoms. And what we found was that bullying on all three of these groups, if you were a victim, if you were a bully, or if you were a bully victim, you are at increased risk for having symptoms of eating disorder.
You know, this is really interesting because in one respect, it's really surprising. But in another respect, maybe it's obvious that those who, I mean, what's cause and what's effect here? Did those who were bullied have eating disorders because they were indeed bullied themselves when they were young? Is that kind of like surprising? Because I guess I think that this is important.
I agree that it's important, but I actually don't think it's surprising. You know, I think so often we focus on the impact of bullying on the victim, and we should. Because it is terrible to be the victim of a bullying episode. But I think what this paper really screams out loud and clear is that we need to pay attention to the mental health of bullies as well. You know, bullying itself is sort of a red flag saying there's something wrong. There's something going on inside that's driving me to this really horrible interpersonal behavior. And I think this particular study shows that one of the dimensions that can be affected really does have to do with anorexia, bulimia, eating disorder symptoms.
Now, with everything that you noticed during your research, being that bullying is such a national topic, can you give us an idea of where the study was located? And when we're talking about putting people at an increased risk for these eating disorders, what kind of risk are we talking about?
Sure. So this was part of the Great Smoky Mountain Study, which is a wonderful longitudinal study that my colleagues at Duke have been conducting for a long time. I think this is another example of what can happen when UNC and Duke work together, you know, great science like this. So we can play together well on the science field. And, you know, this study looked at 1,420 kids, and they were actually studied multiple times between the ages of 9 and 16. And the study takes place in Western North Carolina. Now, I don't really see any reason that we should think that these results would only apply in Western North Carolina. It mirrors clinical experience that people are having across the United States and around the world. So many of our patients will recall episodes of bullying when they were younger, and they will say that they feel inside that those episodes were directly related to the development of their eating disorder, possibly through a pathway of self-esteem or body esteem, or anxiety and depression.
So what do you think is a take-home message for our listeners? I'm thinking about research that I've seen on domestic violence where we focused on the victims appropriately, but we also recognize that the perpetrators really needed counseling and therapy. Is there an analogous message here?
I think there is a perfectly analogous message. I mean, this is where we need to say that we need to pay attention not only to the victims, but to the folks who perpetrate bullying, and also to those poor people who are both. And I think we underestimate how often being bullied can trigger you to bully yourself. It's sort of a way of empowering you in a powerless type of a situation. So all three of these folks need our attention and need to be brought to the attention of mental health care specialists.
Well, we really appreciate you bringing this research to awareness of Your Health listeners, and congratulations on the publication, and I'm sure this is going to lead to further research and insights that will benefit all of us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show, and we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Rudolph Tanzi, Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at the Massachusetts General Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease, about the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's research. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Mir Barzin. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Amir Barzin. Today on Conversations, Amir, we're talking with Dr. Rudolph Tanzi, Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at the Massachusetts General Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease, about the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's research.
Welcome, Dr. Tanzi. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Well, I must say, we are so delighted to have a world-renowned expert, author, researcher on our show today, but I think we'd really like to start off by asking, how did you first get interested in studying neurologic disease? I mean, were you born this way, or how did it develop?
When I got out of college, way, way back, I was lucky enough to work with Jim Gasella at Mass General, and Jim Gasella was the first scientist to find genetic markers in the genome, to find variant in the genome and look for linkage to disease. No one had found the disease gene yet using genetics. It hadn't been done, and he was setting out to do it for the first time with Huntington's disease. You know, and just, you know, today we know of 50 million different variations in the human genome. Back then we knew none. We found the first 5 or 10 of them and then used those in a miraculous stroke of luck to find the gene for Huntington's disease, which is a terrible movement disorder. So I started my career with a bang, you know, with that study with Jim Gasella, and then moved on to do similar things with Alzheimer's disease so I could have my own, you know, project as a student.
What a fascinating background and story. I know that this is actually a topic that many people, in terms of having been exposed to Alzheimer's or having relatives being exposed to Alzheimer's, is really taking a lot of light nowadays. And we have a general idea of what it is, and many of our listeners have a good idea of what Alzheimer's disease is. But can you give us just an overview of what happens in Alzheimer's disease on the molecular level inside the brain? Hmm. And what is functioning or not functioning and what causes disease progression?
Basically, you know, Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia in the elderly. It involves catastrophic decline in cognition, learning, memory, et cetera. And there's been lots of debate over what causes it, but there's also been quite a bit of very interesting and important new data generated just over the last year or two that's finally given us some clarity and agreement in the field with much less debate. And that is that, you know, the genetics that I've worked on, I found the first Alzheimer's genes way back, and all those first genes we found in the 80s and 90s told us that this material in the brain called beta amyloid, it forms the plaques in the brain that form outside of nerve cells, that the amyloid was causing the disease. But then when we tried to create the disease in mice using those genes, they would get the amyloid, but they didn't get the full disease, and that led to a lot of confusion. We invented something last year called Alzheimer's in a dish, which was the first time we could recreate Alzheimer's in a petri dish with mini human brains made from stem cells that we turned into human nerve cells. And doing that, and this was a big study in Nature that was published, and it got all kinds of awards. It landed me on the Time 100 Most Influential People in the World list somehow last year, so it was a big hit. And what we found in that study is, yes, indeed, the amyloid does cause the rest of the disease if you do it in human nerve cells in, you know, a replicated, you know, human brain environment. Mice are not men, and so a lot of the confusion came from mice. Now we all agree the amyloid plaques trigger the disease, and then you get what are called the tangles and the inflammation in the brain that leads to cell death. But here's the thing. Many clinical trials targeting amyloid in patients failed because the amyloid forms in the brain 20 years before symptoms.
Wow.
So this disease is starting 20 years before there are any symptoms. And, you know, we don't call it Alzheimer's disease until we see the symptoms of cognitive failure. But in fact, the disease is beginning 20 years before those symptoms. So a lot of those trials that failed were because we were treating full-blown patients, you know, full-blown Alzheimer's patients for amyloid, which was the equivalent of having someone who just had a heart attack with congestive heart failure and saying, here, just take a Lipitor and lower your cholesterol. You had to do that 15 to 20 years before. Now we've learned from our mistakes. Now the new trials, many of which we're doing, we have a number of different drugs that we're developing with the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. Pharmaceutical companies are doing this. Now started in the amyloid in very early patients or even pre-symptomatic people who by imaging of the brain show they have high amyloid and are at high risk. So it's a whole different mindset now in how we're doing these trials.
We're talking with Dr. Rudy Tanzi, Director of Genetics and Aging Research at Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Tanzi, you would have been on my top 10 list of people that I'm going to just listen to, if only because of you're also the Joseph and Rose Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School, which we just think is very cool. And you have 8 laboratories investing genetics and Alzheimer's disease. Most of us struggle to establish one. But I wonder if you can, and these are amazing things, I want our listeners just to be aware, but there's something that's confusing. And you recently wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about how it's even more complicated than we think, and as you're describing, because there's a gene that increases Alzheimer's risk, while another scientist found the same gene decreases Alzheimer's risk. For those of us in the lay public, even primary care doctors that are trying to figure this out, how do we make sense of this?
Well, that gene is called TREM2. And see, so this story actually goes back to 2008. We first found the gene in 2008 called CD33. We had no idea what it does. You know, it was funny because Time magazine called it a top 10 medical breakthrough of the year. And we said, really? We have no idea what this thing even does. But we, fine, thank you. And then it took us 5 years to figure out that CD33 is the on-off switch for whether you get inflammation in the brain in response to all the cell death and the plaques and the tangles and all the pathology of Alzheimer's. Then a few years later, Decode Genetics, a company in Iceland, found that TREM2 was the off switch. So CD33 and TREM2 were the two switches that determine whether the microglial cells in the brain either stay chilled out and doing their job, cleaning up in the brain, or whether they become inflamed and start shooting out free radicals and you get tons of nerve cell death due to collateral damage or friendly fire. That's how we think about it. So TREM2, certainly we know that genetically it's always consistent that there are mutations in TREM2 that increase risk. But most studies, including our own, have shown that TREM2 is a good guy, that TREM2 chills the microglial cells out so they don't cause inflammation and cause all this friendly fire and nerve cell death. One study came out saying, wait a minute, we see that TREM2 is associated with inflammation. And now, as I said in that review, what the difference is that, you know, microglial cells, if they live in the brain, TREM2 is a good guy. It looks like if there are monocytes from outside the brain that get into the brain, infiltrate the brain, and then turn into microglial cells, which is a totally different, you know, species of cell, and those guys, it looks like TREM2 is a bad guy. So it looks like both sides are right. It depends on whether the microglial cell was resident in the brain, where TREM2 is good, or whether it came in on a monocyte from outside the brain and turned into a microglial cell, then it's bad. So that looks like what solves the mystery.
Sounds like we're trying to figure out who the good guys and the bad guys are, and they can go both ways.
Yeah, yeah. And in any event, we all agree that, you know, in a full-blown Alzheimer's patient, plaques and tangles really did their job early on, and what's really hurting the brain is neuroinflammation. And, you know, there were some very important studies on what are called resilient brains. And it was found that in people who died at a very old age with no cognitive problems, and then you look in their brain by autopsy and you say, man, look at all these plaques and tangles. This looks like an Alzheimer's disease case. And every once in a while, these would turn up around the country. So a colleague of mine here at Mass General collected those brains, and we said, what do they have in common? And every time you saw a brain from a relatively old person who died with no cognitive issues yet had tons of those plaques and tangles, the one thing they had in common was no inflammation. So what we've determined is that you can live a long time with a head full of plaques and tangles and not have Alzheimer's disease, not have symptoms of dementia if you stop the inflammation.
Well,
so a lot of our work now is on exactly how do we do that. And CD33 and TREM2, the genes we were just talking about, are the best targets.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, I think we want to pick up on this idea of inflammation and maybe the relationship between inflammation in the brain, inflammation in the heart and the body. We're talking with our guest, Dr. Rudolph Tanzi, Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at the Massachusetts General Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease, about the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's research. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Mira Barson. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Amir Barzin. We've been talking with our special guest, Dr. Rudolf Tanzi, who's the director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at the Mass General Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease, about the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's research. In our prior conversation, we were getting into the discussion about this idea of inflammation and how it can relate to Alzheimer's disease. So I think that's a great place to pick up. Dr. Tanzi, do you mind talking a little bit more about the role of inflammation and what we see in terms of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, I mean, inflammation is really the big killer when it comes to aging, especially in Alzheimer's disease, but you could argue the same thing in heart disease and stroke and cancer. And even people who look relatively healthy, chronic silent inflammation, which is controlled largely by gene expression, especially by, you know, what we call epigenetics, how our lifestyle, our diet, exercise level affects our gene expression patterns. A lot of that relates to how much inflammation we have in our body. And in fact, I just wrote a whole book about this called Supergenes, as follow-up to my book Superbrain, talking about how our lifestyle dramatically affects our gene expression and how much power we have in terms of programming our gene expression in response to diet, exercise, stress level, et cetera. So that's more of a lay book for folks to use as a guide. And we summarize all the newest studies on how gene expression relates to lifestyle and what you can do with it. Now, in Alzheimer's disease, luckily, in most cases of genetic susceptibility, which is what I work on, there is something you can do about the disease with your lifestyle. And a lot of it comes back to managing inflammation. And as I was saying before the break, you know, when we see these resilient brains, these rare cases of people who die with no cognitive issues, but then their brains look like they're full of plaques and tangles, and you say, how did they not have Alzheimer's? It's no inflammation. So right now we're doing studies to use these genes we found called CD33, another gene that was found in Iceland called TREM2, and saying these are the on-off switches. Let's see if we can find either drugs or lifestyle interventions that will manage these genes and their proteins so as to minimize inflammation. If we do that, we think we can stave off this disease in the vast majority of people who start forming plaques and tangles after 40 years old, which is all of us. I mean, we all start forming these plaques and tangles over 40, but it's how the brain reacts to it with its very primitive innate immune system with inflammation that determines whether you go down that slippery slope to dementia.
Well, you know, you talked about how it works at a genetic level, perhaps, in terms of this expression that can turn on the inflammation or not, even though these tangles may be forming. How does that work when you describe that in your book, Supergene? How does that work in expression in people's lives in terms of things they can do? Because I think the CDC says that there could be 5 million people have Alzheimer's, but that could reach 14 million in 2050. We need to do better.
Yeah, in fact, we say 5.4 million have this disease, meaning they have overt symptoms. But then if you count all the people who have this disease without symptoms yet, I mean, think about cancer. As soon as someone has a tumor, we say they have cancer. We don't wait until they have symptoms of the disease. Same thing with heart disease. If you have enough plaque and calcification, we say you have heart disease. We don't wait until you have a heart attack or a heart failure. In Alzheimer's, we have to have a new mindset that there are people who have enough amyloid plaque in their brain and tangles that are forming and spreading through the brain that although there are no symptoms, they already have Alzheimer's. And if you take that viewpoint, there are probably 10, 20, 30 million people in this country who have pre-symptomatic Alzheimer's disease. The way we fight this is through inflammation, and the best thing we can do, and what I wrote about in Supergenes, is that if we look at all of the newest epigenetic data, mainly from animal studies, where you look at the effects of everything from the gut microbiome to actually emotional stress, to high-fat diets, to even infection with the bacteria that form in periodontal disease in your gums, all these different stressors, that in each case, these cause various gene expression changes that are predictable, where you have hundreds of genes that are all going up and down that are responding and driving that inflammation. And then when you treat that inflammation either with diet or managing the microbiome in different ways, what you'll see is that over time those gene expression patterns change back again. So we're learning now at a big data level, what are the patterns of expression up and down of various genes that say, yes, you're in good shape, no inflammation, or you have a lifestyle that's really highly inflammatory with fast food and no exercise and et cetera, et cetera. So this is where we're going, is using big data and patterns of gene expression across hundreds or thousands of genes at a time to say whether you're on your way to wellness or whether you're in trouble.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's a very good point, especially for us involved in primary care, as we're teaching and trying to educate our patients. We want to look for ways to prevent disease as opposed to treating it after the fact. Now, your research and the work that you've done has been very extensive, especially with the Cures Alzheimer's Fund. And you touched on the research that you guys have been doing, but do you mind kind of going into a little bit more detail about the work that you're doing specifically targeted at treatment and what we can expect to see in the years to come?
Yeah, Cure Alzheimer's Fund, they fund the Alzheimer's Genome Project, which I direct, and that's how we found these genes that control inflammation. In fact, we were the first ones to point out the key role of the genes involved with inflammation as major factors in Alzheimer's, thanks to the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. They also funded our Alzheimer's in a Dish, where we recreated Alzheimer's and mini brains in a dish and solved that debate about whether, amyloid can really lead to tangles in the rest of the disease. And in fact, we're now using Alzheimer's in a dish again with Cure Alzheimer's Fund support to now do drug screening, and it's 10 times faster and 10 times cheaper than it was before when we had to do this in mice. So this foundation is there's no one even close to them in terms of the research they fund. And I should also mention that every dollar they bring in is a dollar out. They take out no overhead at all. Very different than other large Alzheimer's foundations, where if you donate a dollar, you can be sure that it's $1 back out to research, because the founders and board members cover all the overhead, which is very unusual. And our goal going forward is, for those who don't have the disease or symptoms of the disease, the mantra is early prediction, early detection, early intervention. Let's see who's at highest trouble due to family history or genetics. That's early prediction. Use biomarkers and brain imaging to see who's on their way to this disease maybe 10, 15 years from now. And most importantly, for those in trouble, early intervention. Start trying to hit those pathologies that get you to the point of inflammation. Early on, so you never reach symptomatic stages of disease. You can have those plaques and tangles and start bringing them down so you never have inflammation. For those who already have the disease, inflammation is the key, and we need to figure out ways to basically, cool down the fire, so to speak, where you have microglial cells shooting out free radicals and cytokines, causing all kinds of damage. And luckily, again, thanks to Cure Alzheimer's Fund and the Alzheimer's Genome Project, we have the targets. We have CD33, we have TREM2, we also have other ones. And those drug discovery efforts are now going on worldwide. It was Cure Alzheimer's that first came up with this idea, but now there are programs around the world that are using those genes to try to hit neuroinflammation. That's what's going to most help patients who have the disease right now.
So in just a few seconds, I'd like you just to two things. One, if you could say where our listeners can access your 2012 Brain on Super Brain and your most recent one, Super Gene, where they can find and access those books, and we'll put a link up on our website. But also, where do you think things are going to be in 10 years? A little prediction. Not who's going to win between UNC and Duke, but where do you see this in 10 years from now? If we were to have this conversation again, what's your hope?
Well, first of all, UNC and Duke will be even over the next 10 years.
Oh, you're so politically correct.
But first of all, for the books, Super Brain and Super Genes, they're available on any book website like Amazon or Barnes & Noble. So thank you for that mention and for that support. And in terms of 10 years from now, I think there are enough shots on goal right now that we're going to have one or multiple therapies that do successfully bring the amyloid back down. And if we use those therapies early enough, so in other words, let's say over 40 years old or 50, or depending on family history, it could be at 30. You get your brain imaged, you see your amyloid is higher than normal for your age, and then you look into spinal fluid, you see this presence of tangles already by seeing what's called the tau protein accumulating. Then you say, well, we got to start managing your amyloid levels now, just like you manage cholesterol levels in someone who's in trouble with early heart disease before symptoms. I think we're going to have the drugs that allow us to do this early detection, early intervention in the next 5 to 10 years. I have two drugs in trials myself. One was supported by Cure Alzheimer's Fund and is very promising. We also have pharmaceutical companies doing this. You have Biogen, Merck, Lilly, all with different ways of hitting the amyloid. We'll probably have a cocktail to do this, and then what we'll see is that with early detection, early intervention, we're going to stop nipping this disease in the bud. I think we'll start doing that within 10 years.
Well, this cocktail would be one that many people would want to take, and from your mouth to God's ears, Allspeed, we really appreciate your work, your research, your leadership.
And we just want to say thank you so much for being on the show. This has been extremely informative for us, and I know our viewers and listeners are really enjoying this as well. We've been talking with Dr. Rudolf Tanzi, Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at the Mass General Institute for Neurodegenerative Disease, about the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's research.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Amir Barzin. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Amir and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question.
I recently had a colonoscopy, and the biopsy report was confusing, but the gastroenterologist said it was okay. It said I had sessile polyps without dysplasia. This sounds bad to me.
Well, you're not alone in feeling like that. I don't know how many times, Amir, you've seen this, but the biopsy reports, whether it's for a colonoscopy or an upper endoscopy, they look down from above. They're long documents.
Very long documents with a lot of verbiage in there that can sometimes be very difficult to sort through.
Yeah, I even have a hard time sometimes figuring it out. And like the bottom line is it something I have to worry about or not worry about? And that's what I think this listener appropriately wants to know. What do we think on this particular?
Yeah, absolutely. So just in general with colonoscopies, there are different things that we can look at when we take a biopsy. And based off of how the biopsies look, that gives us the interval for what we need to screen for. Mm-hmm. So based off of the findings that we find, we have an idea of whether we need to do a 1, 3, 5, or even 10-year follow-up.
And in this particular case, finding what's called sessile polyps as compared to hyperplastic polyps. So the other type we might normally see, the hyperplastic polyps, you would say, don't worry about those.
Exactly.
But the sessile polyps, they can sometimes be the type that can lead to cancer over a long period of time.
Yes, that's correct. So that's why we would want to see the interval for screening maybe be a little bit shorter than what we would let someone else go with
a hyperplastic polyp. They may say 3 years or 5 years, depending on what they've seen. But I wouldn't worry if I was this patient. I would say, I got a pretty clean report, but I got to follow up in a little bit sooner. What's our very next house call, Daniel?
My husband was just in the hospital for pancreatitis and said it was because of his triglycerides. What can we do to prevent that from happening again?
Oh, well, first off, our hearts go out. Pancreatitis is a very difficult, and we know it's a painful process, and we hope and pray that he's doing better.
Yeah, absolutely. For those of you who may not know, pancreatitis is involving the organ that sits basically in the middle of your stomach called the pancreas. And what it does is that the pancreas actually gets inflamed or swollen.
And people say, what do you need the pancreas for? And the answer is just about everything.
Yeah, the pancreas is very involved in everything.
Anytime you eat, that pancreas is out there chugging away, doing its work to help you digest the food.
That's right. And so it can be very painful, as you can imagine, for people if that's swollen, that anytime they eat, drink, or anything like that, they have some irritation in the area.
And the most frequent cause of this pancreatitis are things that we see more commonly in the hospital, things like gallstones that can kind of irritate and plug up the ducts that where the pancreas is, and then also people who are chronic alcohol users. But in this particular case, it's neither of those things. it's the diet and the triglycerides that are part of our normal foods that we're eating, but in our body raise up, and I guess in this particular case, dangerous.
Yes, that's correct. And even sometimes in patients who are hospitalized for this, there's procedures that we can do to kind of pull out the triglycerides. But most importantly for prevention, it's trying to refrain from eating fatty foods and trying to drive down your triglycerides through proper medication use.
Yeah, one of the things I say is you got to give up the bread. Give up the bread. Also, alcohol sometimes really can raise them. So it's a diet and lifestyle and oftentimes medications. Great question. Thank you so much. What's our very next house call, Daniel?
My nephew has been treated for schizophrenia for many years now, and he's developed what the doctors call tardive dyskinesia. It seems awful. Is there anything we can do about it?
Oh, wow. That's really tough. And a heart goes out because having a relative with a serious psychiatric problem like schizophrenia is very difficult. And then having a significant side effect like this tardive dyskinesia. Amir, what do we know about at least what is tardive dyskinesia?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that with treatment of some of our typical and atypical antipsychotics, people can get what's called tardive dyskinesia. And this basically involves grotesque, repetitive, or involuntary movements and typically seen in the face or in the lips of a patient.
And this becomes very concerning both to the patient because you're kind of constantly moving. It's hard. You can't stop and you're aware of it. But then also to people who are with the person because they're also constantly moving. So this is a debilitating psychological. It's also debilitating physically. And the single best thing we can do is really prevent it if we can by not having people on medications that they don't need to be on. And there's a common medicine that we should try to avoid, but we give sometimes called Reglan, for instance, metoclopramide, difficult word to say. But it's a common medicine to help stimulate some people's food who otherwise may get stuck, but it can cause this. And so we have to always be aware and stop that medicine if indeed this seems to be starting up. You may need to really talk with a neurologist. There's botulism injections, toxin injections, other sorts of drugs that can be used, work with the psychiatrist, see if there's any possibility to get a different antipsychotic than the one that was causing it. Difficult situation. You're going to need a team approach here. Really good luck. Thanks for sharing that difficult situation. What's our very last house call, Daniel?
My wife is 74 and has liver failure from fatty liver disease. She's doing pretty well now, but I wonder how long is she likely to live?
Wow. Again, our hearts go out because being given a diagnosis of fatty liver disease, we kind of toss those terms around, but for a lot of people, they can develop liver failure, what's called cirrhosis of the liver. And for a lot of people, that ultimately can be a fatal disease.
Absolutely. And we see this on the hospital side of what we do, unfortunately, more frequently than we would like. But what we do know is that if liver disease does progress to cirrhosis, there are some great risk calculators such as the MELD score that can give us an idea of how advanced disease is in pretty much a three-month interval of time frame.
So if they have a low platelet count in their blood counts, if they have a high bilirubin, another chemical in their bloodstream.
Yeah, so those things, and along with the kidney function and then the way that their blood clots or their INR, we can kind of calculate what their three-month mortality would be.
Really, again, a team approach here. Work with your primary care doctor. Work with your liver specialist. A good, healthy lifestyle would be good for all of us, but particularly for you.
Absolutely.
Well, that's going to be all that we can do for house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health, and you can share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and for our guests today, Dr. Cynthia Bulick and Dr. Rudolph Tanzi.
On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carrboro's News, Talk, and Tar Heel Station.